First of all, I'd like to welcome you all to the first in a series of events that we will be hosting and also co-hosting with partners over the next 3 weeks as part of the Visions of Feminist Peace program. Now, the program of events has been made possible by a 3-year grant from the Arts and Humanities Research Council awarded to the Feminist International Law of Peace and Security project almost 2.5 years ago. My name is Louise Arimatsu, and I'll be chairing today's panel discussion, International Law and Agenda Justice Peace. Before introducing our speakers, a couple of housekeeping matters. First, in addition to Zoom, many of you are joining us via Facebook, and as is now common or standard protocol with these public events, you have all been muted, but you've not been silenced. We urge you to share your views, comments, or indeed any questions you may have during this event via the chat box. We'd also like to hear from the destination or location from which you have been joining us. I'm sorry about this. My neighbours are having some building works done, so excuse the noise from time to time. In terms of format, our speakers have been invited to share their views with us for around 5 to 7 minutes each. This will be followed by discussion among and between them. In the last 30 minutes, we'd like you to join in this conversation. So my colleagues and I will be picking up on the comments and the questions from the chat box. In terms of technology, we've come a long way and probably faster than any of us could have imagined 9 months ago. Of course, many of us are amongst super privileged. We have access to this technology. Having said that, the technology sometimes lets us down. So there is a plan B in the event that I lose connection. My colleague, Sarah Smith, who is coordinating everything behind the scenes, will take over as chair. So housekeeping done, I want to turn to the reason for why we're all here, and it's to hear from our speakers, to learn from them, to be inspired by them. It's my pleasure and an enormous privilege for me to welcome them today. Many of you are probably already familiar with their work, whether it's scholars or it's practitioners. Each is an exceptional lawyer and an expert in multiple and intersecting fields of international law, from international criminal law, international humanitarian law, human rights law, and refugee law. Moreover, each has the intellectual gift for being able to bridge theory and practice. For weeks now, I personally have been looking forward to bringing them together to share, exchange their views, and to probe the limits and even the potential of the law. When we approached our speakers, we asked, perhaps invited them to think about their area of expertise through the prism of a feminist peace. We did not define what we meant by feminism, feminist, nor of peace. We left open the idea of feminist peace. What we were trying to do was to avoid predetermining the frame, the content, the direction, the focus of the exchange that we hope to have. We wanted to capture an openness, a fluidity in how to engage with international law whilst remaining faithful to our discipline. And I think that is how Christine and I have approached this project more broadly. On one level, this hasn't been problematic. The maintenance of peace and security is the core objective of the international legal order as set out in Article 1.1 of the UN Charter. Yet, what is meant by peace remains largely unaddressed in law. And I think it's this, call it provocation, temptation, that lies at the core of our work. And one issue that we continue to confront and revisit is the rupture, the disconnect between the law's construction and the lived reality. And if that is the case, how can justice be achieved, let alone a gender-just peace? Now, this is a question that our speakers are likely to pick up on and expand on. And I don't want to preempt what they're going to speak to. So I'm going to hand over the floor to them. Patricia Sellers will, by feminist consensus, speak first, joining us from Brussels. She will be followed by Cordula from Geneva, Mo from Dhaka, and Monica here in London. So over to you, Patty.
Thank you very much, Louise. Welcome, everyone. And also a huge gratitude for LSE and Women, Peace and Security allowing this discussion to take place. Let me jump in right away. So I'm speaking from a perspective of a combination of practice from the international courts and tribunals, and particularly with international humanitarian law and international criminal law. And the first thing I would like to posit and put on the table is to remember that, you know, there is no prohibition against having broken, in essence, the peace as a war crime. Hold up. I know you're going to say, what about aggression? But let's just go into the Geneva regime. There is no war crime called of breaking the peace. And it begs, of course, the question of what could peace be? When we get to aggression, very interestingly, the one crime that has joined the Rome Statute rather tardy, because it took over 10 years to discuss what is aggression, not what is peace, but what is aggression. But the two are very linked. And I don't want to use in a very facetious way the concept of binary. It's not as if we look at all of the different provisions under the crime of aggression, such as occupation, such as sending a militia into a third country, and say, well, that must equate breaking the peace because it equals going into situations of armed conflict or war. But I would like to throw up another question, and that is, why do we think of war militarization as being so monolith, as per se, not having any cracks where the lights of peace get in? Well, I would like to offer a few. And I do this in the spirit of saying we have to understand what is the construct to use maybe a feminist concept from decades ago to deconstruct, but maybe to use a feminist concept of today is to understand that the binary is fluid. As war is a process, armed conflict is a process, aggression is a process. We've already posited in yesterday's opening of this forum that peace is a dynamic process. So let's look at one state of war, its conclusion, where we have peace accords. One would say peace has arrived, and therefore we are back to, in quotes, the good old days, which was probably a non-gendered peace anyway. But hold up, humanitarian law says that we can still have war crimes after peaceful conclusion, because until all prisoners are repatriated, war crimes can occur. That makes us understand that even after peace, we can have war. And so therefore, conclusions by peace treaties does not necessarily symbolize the arrival of peace. If we would go to the Security Council, as Louise and Christine spoke about briefly yesterday, we can understand that its main preoccupation is touted as looking at breaches in the peace, trying to maintain the peace, or to restore the peace. And therefore, one of the tools, which is a political tool that it uses, is to find out when has the peace been breached by illegal use of force. But here's when the international courts and tribunals have come in. Excuse me, I live near a hospital, and these are COVID ambulances rushing people to the hospital with police escorts. This is the world in which we now exist, right? I wish the patients well in the hospital. So if we get to the Security Council resolution, we know that under Chapter 7 is when they bring to full force, looking at breaches of the peace, maintaining the peace, or restoring the peace. When we look at the establishments of the international courts and tribunals, such as Yugoslavia and Rwanda, and we can even kind of morph the International Criminal Court into that, we realize that peace can be breached under Chapter 7 not just in relationship to armed conflict or war, but in relationship to genocide. The Rwanda Tribunal was set up because peace was breached due to a genocide. We also understand that under crimes against humanity, whether it's customary basis or its statutory basis as placed within the Rome Statute and possibly in the new Crimes Against Humanity Treaty, is that crimes against humanity can represent for the Security Council a Chapter 7 breach in the peace. But crimes against humanity does not necessarily have to have a nexus to an armed conflict. So already at the very basis, we know that peace does not necessarily and always equal the opposite of armed conflict. So if we just delve a tiny bit into crimes against humanity with the presumption that crimes against humanity represent a time period when Chapter 7 can be invoked, which means when there's been a breach in the peace and the peace needs to be restored, it means that extermination must be a breach of the peace. Imprisonment, all the sexual violence, whether it be rape, whether it be forced sterilizations, forced pregnancies, they must be breaches in the peace. And even more relevant, I think, is that persecution, when it is committed as part of a crime against humanity, meaning a widespread or systematic attack against the civilian population, must be a breach in the peace, because it can have the Security Council's invocation of Chapter 7 in response to it. So I think looking at the different ways in which we really see the Security Council has been moved from what looks like a monolithic, peace means the absence of armed conflict, or armed conflict means there is no peace, really has been not frayed around the edges, but has really been dismantled. When we look at the genocide in Rwanda, potentially the genocide in Myanmar, the genocide in Cambodia, these are breaches of the peace. Therefore, one cannot be at peace when children are being transferred to another group of people, which is one of the provisions of genocide. So I would even argue that under Canada, the United States, or Australia, when we had the transfer of Indigenous children to a different group, that that was a breach of the peace and that was not a peaceful situation. I've thrown out these examples and a bit of our dismantling, deconstructing fluidity, bringing in a feminist perspective to show that it's not just the cracks in war or the cracks in military. It is where peace has to be reconfigured and re-understood and reconceptualized away from just militarization. It borders on, it breaches into our understanding of human rights. It breaches into our understanding of what is peaceful existence. Now, there needs to be a further, I think, gender analysis of looking at all the people who live in these, what I would say, enlightened parts of peace that we tend to ignore because we've shoved it too much under a military configuration. I hope that we can not only conceptualize, that we can acknowledge, and that we can expand this purview of a gendered feminist peace and not be so locked ourselves in what the Security Council seems to take on as a whole, that there is either peace or there is war. Their very practice shows that that is incorrect. And so I'll stop my remarks there and thank you once again for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you, Cathy. So, Kotula, can I invite you to share some of your views with us?
Thanks a lot, Louise, and thanks to the LSE Center for Women, Peace and Security for inviting me to be here. And I want to also greet all the people who've introduced themselves on the Zoom chat, and I'm thinking I would like to have all of your jobs. They look so interesting. So it's really great to be here. Now, you've asked us to identify components of a feminist peace and how the notion of a feminist peace might be possible in today's international legal framework and what changes in structures we might need. So I would like to focus on first the notion that a feminist peace will be better facilitated if the violence of conflict doesn't deepen pre-existing gender inequalities, that the seeds of a feminist peace must take root already in the midst of contemporary conflicts. In other words, the way wars are fought are an important component, I think, of this discussion towards peace. And then I then would like to say a couple of words on the humanitarian response during conflict and what that means for a feminist peace. Before I launch into this, I just need to say a couple of words about the relationship between international humanitarian law and peace, which is a controversial one, in the sense that IHL seeks to limit the effects of armed conflict by protecting people who are not or no longer taking part in hostilities and by limiting the means and methods of war. It's not about ending war, and it's not about building peace. And this, of course, has attracted criticism in the sense that it has been said that IHL permits or legitimizes war and shifts the conversation away from condemning war in and of itself to deliberations about how war would be fought. And actually, one of the first peace activists, Bertha von Suttner, in the beginning of the last century, who was a good friend of Henri Dunant, the founder of the International Committee of the Red Cross, was quite ambivalent when he got the Nobel Peace Prize. And she wrote this letter to a friend saying, well, I really like this nice old man, and I really admire him for having achieved something that I would like to achieve, which is to have an international convention and a structure set up. But really, do they need to give the first peace prize to someone who's just, you know, working on regulating war? So I think that's been a bit of a tension ever since. But it's also true that since its inception, the ICRC has always understood itself as an organization that paves the way towards peace. There are many pronouncements by the founders already of the ICRC saying we are not against peace, quite on the contrary. And in the experience, I think, over the years of the ICRC, what we see is that real respect for IHL, international humanitarian law, reduces wartime suffering and can pave the way towards peace. So in that sense, I think we need to look at these linkages between the societal goals of peace, security, and women's rights, but also the response to humanitarian crisis when it occurs. And I'd argue perhaps that there could be three steps to analyze this. The first step is, of course, to better understand the gendered impacts of armed conflict and the disproportionate effects that conflicts have on women. It's very clear, and I don't need to say this to this audience, of course, that war is a gendered phenomenon, and that the impact of war on women and girls intersects with their race, shows social status, class, age, and on other factors, and perpetuates and indeed exacerbates existing structural inequalities. So just to give a couple of examples, if you think, for instance, about fleeing or escaping from hostilities, this can be more difficult for women because you have gender norms that often dictate that women's are responsible for the care of children or older relatives, and this might make it more difficult for them to flee actual and impending attacks. You might have restrictions of movements due to gender norms or indeed actually to legislation, which make it more difficult for women to move, particularly without consent of some male members of their families. You might have women who may be more at risk of being used as human shields because in the sort of general scheme, they are then seen more as innocent civilians, and so they face this risk. You have, of course, also the effects of war on men that have a direct and a reverberating effect on women, and I would think particularly of the issue of missing persons. So the overwhelming majority of missing persons in armed conflict are men. But when men disappear, this can also lead to the marginalization of wives without husbands. It can lead to problems to claim compensation, to access bank accounts, to access authorities. Often women might not have the knowledge about the administrative processes, which were until then really the responsibility of their husbands. You have clearly disproportionate effects on access to resources and very clearly on the risk of extreme poverty for women. So resources are scarce, of course, in conflict. They become more scarce, and you have intersecting factors such as gender, age, disability, and so on, that make it more difficult to access those resources, and particularly for women who typically have fewer financial resources. You have household responsibilities and childcare responsibilities of women, which means that when you have a disruption and destabilization of food security, of water resources, of child education, it increases the burden and the work burden on women. Sexual violence, of course, in conflict also affects men and boys, but it disproportionately affects women and girls. They're targeted often for their very reproductive capacities. They're targeted to be humiliated, to degrade their dignity. And so perhaps the last example, and this is perhaps one that's less known, is also that the choice of weapons can have gendered impacts. For instance, in our biology of women, women store greater degree of toxicity from toxic remnants of war. And there's quite interesting studies, for instance, about nuclear weapons and the effects that the toxicity has on women's bodies as opposed to men's bodies. So much more still needs to be done to analyze these disproportionate effects. The second step, I would argue, is to emphasize that a gender-just peace starts with gender-just rules and the application of those rules during conflict. Now, IHL contains both general and specific rules that protect women. So, of course, each of the Geneva Conventions and additional protocols requires humane treatment without any adverse distinction founded, amongst others, on sex. So it prohibits discrimination. And, of course, a modern understanding of this means that it not only puts negative obligations on parties to conflict, but of course also positive obligations to achieve real equality, for instance, to access humanitarian relief in armed conflict, which can, you know, have lots of hurdles that are different for women, men, girls and boys. And then you have a number of IHL rules that specifically articulate differentiated treatment for women, for instance, on prisoners of war or civilian internees, on besieged areas. And the commonality, to put it in a nutshell, is that it requires the belligerents to give due regard to the specific needs and risks that women are faced with. Now, of course, these rules are also a product of their time, particularly the rules of the Geneva Conventions of 1949. And they're often articulated, or sometimes articulated, in terms that wouldn't meet today's standards. So, for instance, sexual violence in the 1949 conventions is construed as an attack on women's honor, rather than, as we would conceptualize it today, as a violence to women's physical and psychological integrity. And we today, of course, have to interpret these according to contemporary practice and legal requirements. And what this means is, again, I think, to take into account in the interpretation of the rules the specific risks that women and girls face in armed conflict situations. And then the third step, I think, is to look at the humanitarian response during armed conflict. Because in addition to the relevant laws governing the actions of parties to conflicts, how humanitarian actors shape the response in conflict has a critical role to play in ensuring that women in the communities in which we work can shape the collective humanitarian response. So, if you will, in parallel to the Women, Peace and Security agenda of the Security Council from 20 years ago, which required, as one of its main causes, the greater participation of women in the prevention and resolution of conflict and in peace building, so the humanitarian response today must also offer greater participation of women in shaping humanitarian programs, because the ultimate goal of those humanitarian programs has to be to strengthen their own coping, positive coping mechanisms. And an intersection analysis will help us to bring a sharper focus that within the community themselves that we are trying to bring relief and protection to as humanitarian actors, there are different interests and values and conflict and exclusion and bias. And so having an intersectional analysis of this, I think, helps us to challenge assumptions and stereotypes, which we may also bring. So just to give an example, for instance, when we undertake humanitarian action in favor of displaced person, the issue is not only to give a voice to displaced persons, but to really dig deeper and to look at the different sub-communities that you can find and that have different risks and needs. Another example would be perhaps, and I mentioned it before, the fact that women's voices must be heard from day one of the conflict in the search of missing persons. As I said, the majority of people going missing in armed conflict are men, with devastating impacts on the psychological, economic and societal impact on their families. And it's often women, so the wives, the mothers, the grandmothers, who will be at the forefront of the search for the missing, to acknowledge their memory, but also to fight impunity and fight for justice. And I want to mention this particular example because it's been an inspiration to me for many years in my life, because it's not only an example of the specific suffering endured by women, but it's also an example to illustrate the courage and the strength and the solidarity of many associations of families, members of missing persons, who are often represented, in fact, by women. So if you think, for instance, of the mothers or grandmothers of Plaza de Mayo, who, you know, over the years have really supported also many other associations of families of missing persons. So I'll close the remarks just with a final reflection on this connection between the gendered impact of conflict, humanitarian law and action, and visions for a feminist peace. Today's conflicts are protracted and urbanized, of course, and they not only kill and maim, they destroy systems, they destroy infrastructure, they destroy economies, and they destroy societies. And we know that women are being and will continue to be disproportionately affected as the cities around them crumble. Now, humanitarian actors are not peace builders. Neutral, impartial, and independent humanitarian action is distinct from the political process of peace negotiation and peace building, and it must remain so. Yet I would argue that while others make peace, humanitarian action helps to make peace possible. And if the voices of women and girls are not present in shaping humanitarian response, it moves the feminist peace further out of reach. Thank you.
Thank you, Cordula, for those really for your insights, and I think this is going to raise all sorts of possibilities for further exchange between the panelists. But let me bring in Mo here. Mo is joining us from Dhaka, so I hope the power sort of remains stable. Cordula just picked up on several points that perhaps you want to also develop in your talk about displacement and the gendered impact of specifically displacement on women. So over to you, Mo.
Thank you, Louise. And thank you again to the Centre for inviting me to this panel. I'm glad that despite the distance, we can have a forum of this kind to be able to talk about these issues. So thank you again to the Centre. I will be talking about feminist peace in the context of refugee law, and in particular how the framing of peace, as mentioned already by both Louise and Patricia, as being sort of an absence of war, and why that is problematic, particularly in the refugee sphere. Firstly, it's problematic because it focuses on establishing peace in the country of origin. So there is an automatic assumption that by virtue of the displacement that has occurred, that individuals that have crossed an international border are in fact in a situation of peace. And sometimes that is conflated with safety, essentially. And while that may be the case, there is a broader discussion to be had about whether individuals are indeed in a situation of peace once they have crossed an international border. And of course, refugee law essentially is expected to be temporary. It's supposed to afford temporary protection, surrogate protections, and it's also in search of durable solutions. What's interesting, though, about the durable solutions that refugee law is in search of is that they are voluntary repatriation, resettlement, and local integration. implicit in all of those aspects is the concept that peace exists in all three, but it's not necessarily explicit. And we talk about voluntary repatriation as being as having conditions which are conducive to return for refugees. Is peace conditional for that to happen? Sometimes not necessarily. It's often an assumption that indeed there will be peace upon return for those that choose to be voluntarily repatriated to their countries of origin. I also wanted to talk very briefly about this concept of refugee protection being temporary, because as we know from both history and current situations, refugee situations are more often protracted now. And so this idea of being in a state of peace in situations where individuals have crossed international borders is, again, requires a bit of a rethink, because many refugees are in protracted situations, and i.e. that's 5 years plus of having crossed an international border. And as we know, displacement itself amplifies the vulnerabilities, it exacerbates pre-existing inequalities, and it gives rise to new gendered risks. So it's interesting to consider whether those individuals are, in fact, given that they're living for long periods of time in the countries of refuge, whether that is indeed a sufficient situation of peace. And in fact, in practice, what often happens, and particularly I want to talk about the situation in Bangladesh, is where countries are not, who have not acceded to the Refugee Convention, for example, that it's essentially left up to the humanitarian actors, the development actors, the international financial institutions, and often the government in the country of refuge to create a semblance of peace in those particular situations. And in practice, that challenge is a very difficult one, partly because there are already existing power structures that are in place. There are, of course, numerous barriers for women across the different sectors. And there are also many societal norms and attitudes and beliefs which prevent the participation of certain individuals, namely often women and girls. So in all, I think the contribution that I would like to highlight is that there is the definition of peace in its current form of being sort of negatively placed does mean that this assumption of having peace in the refugee sphere is somewhat skewed, because in practice, although individuals may have safety, i.e. there are not bombs, you know, they're not facing crimes, etc., the reality is that they are confined by the rules imposed by the country of refuge, and they're also confined by other societal norms, and also the often the conflict with host communities as well. So the question arises whether, in fact, there is peace in displaced contexts as well. Thank you very much, and I'll leave the questions for discussion. Thank you,
Mal, for sharing your insights, your experience. You know, you're one of the very few people who I know who's working on the front line right now in very, very difficult situation. At this point, I'd like to bring in Monica. Monica, I think you may have turned your camera off.
Sorry. Are
you there? Great. Okay. Monica, can I invite you to share some of your reflections and views?
Sure. Well, I must say I'm delighted to be part of this panel. Some of the ideas that are being put forward are actually extremely important for the conception of international law that we are aiming to have, and understanding the trajectory of international law as it should be. I am grateful for the opportunity to share some ideas. And I want to start by perhaps going back to the initial remarks of Christine Chinkin and Louis yesterday, when they were wondering, also, you know, in addition to this law that we are discussing, the running theme of women activism in different areas, and which was, as they acknowledged, constant, struggle for peace, and how that fed into the narrative of international law and the international law that we have today, that we know today, that we are discussing now. So how does that fit? And you, Louis, made a point that that women activism had been somehow sidelined and ignored. Perhaps my key proposition is that I do feel that that activism has had a great impact in international law, that perhaps has not been acknowledged as it should. And I think that impact is going to continue shaping international law to the direction it's currently taking. Now, I would like to reflect on two separate areas, starting by this wonderful opening that Patricia gave us, which is basically that when we think about conflict, it doesn't have to be in the context of an acknowledged armed conflict. And second, in that context, I'm going to discuss realities. I am counsel. I act for victims and for survivors of a number of violations. And I like to use a number of examples throughout my 20 years of practicing international law in dispute settlement to illustrate the importance of these two areas. So the first one is a situation of conflict in the way we have understood that traditionally, armed conflict. And second, I like to make a number of observations in the context that goes beyond that and takes it to a new area that is really the area of environmental law, climate change fights that are, in my opinion, very much led in to a great degree by women. So starting with the first area, I think that Cordelia pointed out a very important example on the issue of disappearances. And this is something I gave attention 20 years ago because of my closeness to the region, obviously Latin America. And it is quite important because of the following. So if you think about the democratization processes in Latin America's very young states, the conflicts didn't start, certainly you don't have international armed conflicts. There hasn't been international armed conflicts there with minor incidents, you know, that has been from time to time concerning borders. We are talking about modern time, not the century before the actual constitution of these modern states. But we have had principally civil wars. So Latin America has been that the scenario that Cordula described of protected and urbanized armed conflict. Now, the start of that, though, was not really with civil wars. We have had decades of dictatorships. So it has been a total absence, you know, of war. You know, it has, and yet we have had crimes against humanity being committed in a widespread manner throughout the region. And Chile is a clear example of that, whereby there was never war. Second, Argentina is a very good example of that. So yes, the Madres de Plaza de Mayo were the first civil law society group that actually acknowledged that there was a practice that needed a name. It needed to be, there had to be a legal term to actually coin that illegality under international law. And up to that time, nobody had ever in the UN yet dealt with that. So when the mothers go to the UN, they call them locas. Locas mean in Spanish crazy women, because they didn't understand what they were talking about. So we own these fights and these women movements and this persistent and stubborn challenging the law and seeking a response from the law to address the atrocities that they were experiencing because of their children being disappeared. We own them the standards that we have today and that has been applied not just in Latin America, but in the entire world. They have a major impact, not just in the UN system and with that beyond, but in the Inter-American system. Obviously, the Inter-American Court started working with all these different realities. And the first ever case of disappearance was the Velázquez Rodríguez case, which set out many important considerations on the law of state responsibility, which, you know, notions of due diligence, notions of positive obligations that otherwise would have not been there. So they started being developed with that seminal case brought and understood because of the fights of all these women. So there you are not only going to have the example of Argentina, but seriously also the example of Chile. The case of the dictator Pinochet, when it came to London, I had the opportunity to follow the proceedings because I had a small role in the legal work that aimed to for the extradition of Pinochet. And I remember meeting some of the refugees that came to London, and many of these, as it was put nicely, women's peace builders, you know, these activist women were their gender were basically female. I mean, all these associations of women from Chile, from the disappeared, etc., came to London, and also from the tortured, and they were the ones that pushed for the prosecution of for the yes to the extradition. Obviously, you know what was the outcome. It won. It had a major effect on the law of immunities worldwide. I mean, you know, this impacted the traditional area of international law, which is the law of impunity. So it's human rights law having an impact on a very traditional area of international law, such as the law of immunities, asserting restrictive immunity for specific cases when it had to do, for example, with issues of allegations of torture. So moving on from that concept, we and tidying up now to the considerations made by Patricia in the context of the civil war, it's not always the case that we are going to have acknowledged civil wars. You know, that there is a, in reality, doesn't work like that. It's not like from this moment we are having a civil war and therefore international humanitarian law is applying. The best example of that that comes to my mind is Peru. Peru, unlike Colombia, there was never an acknowledgement in real time that there was a civil war. It was understood as a different phenomenon, as terrorism, as breaking the law. So when you have a situation that you actually the acknowledgement of the applicability of international humanitarian law came after a truth commission. Actually, you know, we actually lived through a war, and therefore those were the standards. That's extremely interesting, but that challenges us. And I bring that as an example because that means that, brings that point of Patricia, processes and fluidity and how that challenges the law. But at the same time, how we keep an eye on the need also of not separating, having an eye for the interconnections of different legal regimes. And here I pause and I highlight the key role that therefore women have had on what comes after those processes, whether civil wars, etc. And that has to do with these transitional justice processes, sometimes not too transitional, because sometimes, you know, those were in power that were in power when crimes were committed come back to power. So it is a very, it's not a clear cut transition, but sometimes it happens like that. What happens in that context is that women have worked tremendously on those justice seeking processes, and we have had great success on that. And I'd like to give a number of examples, but if you look at the jurisprudence of the Inter-American Court, to a great extent, I would say that the massacres that had been eventually asserted as massacres with legal consequences, etc., have been defined the fight of women. Clearly, because in my opinion, if I think about my clients, you know, and their reasons, I think that I think it's this closeness, either as you put it so clearly, Cordula, as mothers or sisters, or they just cannot be happy with accepting that such a wrong so close to them can be left in impunity. So the fight against impunity has been dealt by women, particularly in the region that I'm talking about. I am proud to say that one of the cases that I led obtained a outstanding result, in the sense that for the first time ever in the Inter-American system, not only the massacre was acknowledged, but most importantly, it was the first time that rape was acknowledged to be an international crime, a violation of the American Convention on Human Rights, and a violation of the regional treaty on non-violence against women. And that led to specifically seek the prosecution of a former head of state. It was the first time, and I think the sole time, that the Human Rights Tribunal ordered the prosecution of a former head of state for crimes that were also against women, and that the rape was amounting to crimes against humanity in that context. And this obviously has an impact on the practice then, because once you have the first case against impunity, that shaken somehow consciousness. And also people are careful in their own jurisdictions, you know, it's not that you can get away with it. And that process of judicialization and going to courts and seeking remedies have had a great impact generally on the law, and how now domestic systems had to internalize those standards and be now entering into a different process. So the feminization of international human rights law in the Americas have happened that way from that moment in 2006, and have used for that the two regimes, international humanitarian law and human rights law, together in order to protect human rights, including the rights of women. Now, moving on to, so just a last comment on this big area of conflict conceived as war and also in concerning the need for remedies. I'd like just to make one comment that was quite important concerning refugee law, etc. I had the opportunity to look at the situation of South Sudan. And this is it. I mean, what is applied after you have a context where you are not in the middle of the conflict, okay, but that's, you are in a refugee camp. What happens with your rights? I was shocked to see the level of sexual violence happening in this context, you know, women in refugee camps. And I was shocked by the fact that they had multiplicity of actors when it came to perpetrators. Allegations not only of rape that came from combatants, but rape coming from even, you know, forces that were supposed to be building peace. So this is a gap there for a need of more clarity and justiciability of such acts. And where do you go with that? Finally, I'd like to move to a completely different area, which is, you know, more leaving the notion of conflict in the way we have understood it so far in the discussion, and going towards the area of when the right to life is threatened in a systematic way, even in a context that maybe, for example, environmental Italy speaking. In Latin America right now, if we think about conflicts in society, the number one issue is issues concerning environmental law. Why? Because you have a big presence of extractivism, and this is all coming obviously from concessions, the private sector, a state's lack of regulations of things. So you are having a lot of extraction of minerals, gold, copper, etc. It's endless. Throughout the region, that's the main type of conflict. And what I have discovered is two things. Number one, women have been very much at the front line of bringing those cases, bringing cases for justice in those sort of scenarios. And I have also found that because NGOs have, to a great extent, female forces, I have found that women are also highly represented among lawyers taking up those cases, these very difficult cases, which actually points out that there is a big influence there. From the perspective of women on how those processes of litigation are framed. And I think that's very, very interesting to observe. I think climate change is perhaps now the key and the most disturbing feature that we are facing as collectively, as humanity. And I believe that women are playing a very important role in leading some of the most important campaigns, and also this awareness of obviously the responsibility for future generations and what type of world we live for them. So this is you know the landscape that I see and the role that I see women are playing, and I completely agree with my colleagues in broadening up you know the notions that traditionally we had, because they hadn't worked in that way as originally theoretically conceived. It's been richer. And I would like to leave you just with one important conclusion, and that is that the different regimes of international law overlap in many contexts. And it's very important to actually see that fluid interaction and have this communication of specialisms in order to achieve the purpose to read a provision, for example, that comes from the UN Charter in its full light and full purpose. Thank you.
Thank you, Monica, for sharing your thoughts and also your experiences involved in the law and making it work. You know, looking back, you know, reflecting on each one of your interventions, there's so many things to pick up on. But I think, you know, I just want to highlight a couple of items before bringing you all back in again. This notion of this artificial divide between war and peace, and how that really does not reflect the reality of what is happening in people's lives. The temporality problem of the law that is also artificial, that constructs these divides again. Then as lawyers, how then do we use the interconnections between different legal regimes? And I think that it's really listening to your experiences, it's the ability to identify and enter the spaces in between and make use of those spaces in between to secure some kind of justice. Women's role in history, and you know that sort of suppressed, forgotten role that is there that we need to surface and learn from and build on. And then also this notion of violence that we keep on coming back to, the distinction that law makes between public violence and private violence. That distinction, you know, as a feminist, you know, we see violence as a continuum, and this is something that we keep on repeating. But we fight in one respect, we fight against understanding the reality of that continuum, against the law's construction of violence and what answers we can seek to secure through the law. Would any of the panelists, Kati, Mo, Cordula, would you like to jump in here to either pick up on any of the comments made by your fellow panelists, or to reflect further before I do bring in the audience, because I'm so aware that we are actually running sort of slightly over time, but I would like to bring in the audience, you know, sort of in the next 10 minutes or so. Kati.
Yes, I just have one quick comment, and I'm happy, Louise, that you brought it up, because this divide between public-private that also was something very much within feminist theory, particularly, I would say, in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, to try and bring the state responsibility into areas that had been considered almost physically private, such as the house or the home. I think that now we're in a completely different era. So when we hear Mo speak about refugee law, Cordula speaking about humanitarian law, human rights law, as Monica has framed it, even regional human rights law, and myself with ICL, these are all per se public spheres. We should not even think that anything that happens to any woman, child, man, or boy under refugee law or under crimes against humanity or under genocide, the transferred children, has nothing to do with private anymore. So we need to make sure that we don't apply a schema of private as if it were something, a situation that we therefore couldn't reach by law under these different, you know, as we're saying, interconnected legal regimes that we're discussing today. We are completely so much in the public sphere that means that impunity cannot be allowed to reign. Just wanted to make that quick comment.
I'm pointing as though we're in the same room. Cordula.
Yes, hi. I also wanted to pick up on this question that you talked about, this dichotomy between these concepts of peace and conflict. And I mean, Patricia gave me a lot of pause to think as well about this question that clearly already now we see some of these violations, grave violations like genocide, crimes against humanity, as breaches of the peace, or perhaps as threats to the peace. And also, it was interesting what you said, Monica, about Argentina and Chile. And it's true that I mentioned the mothers of Plaza de Mayo, but of course, these were not conflict situations. And yet I think they were so violent that we still use those as, you know, in common parlance, you would call it conflictual situations. And on the other hand, you have a place like Peru, but it's the same, you know, in other places like Syria, etc., where conflict isn't even acknowledged. And that also is a problem, I think. And so, Louise, you were asking, so what do we make of this as lawyers? And I think we need to, first of all, acknowledge that real peace is also just an equal peace, and that it's not just about, you know, absence of IHL defined war. And so that when we transition towards peace, particularly for women, but you know, in for all factor, you know, parts of society, you have to take peace together with respect for human rights and sustainable development. And nonetheless, I also think that there is reason for the dichotomy as lawyers between, you know, armed conflict and situations that are not armed conflict. And we have to be careful also about giving them up, because if we blur the lines of what is conflict and what is not conflict, we also blur the lines of which law is applicable. And that, from a perspective of IHL, can be problematic, particularly in the interplay between IHL and human rights. Because human rights apply at all times. They're inherent to the human being. They apply in peacetime and they apply in times of conflict. IHL only applies in times of conflict, with the exceptions, of course, that some of us has mentioned, that certain you know, obligations like training and setting up structures have to be put into place before, and other things have to still continue afterwards, like obligation to search for the missing. But most of it applies during armed conflict. And that, in a way, is something that we have to be careful not to expand too much by expanding the concept of conflict, because by applying IHL, you do have a more permissive possibility to use force by the authorities and other belligerents. And so if we expand the notion of conflict to include other situations that may be violent, we can give more leeway, and this can of course lead to further violence and violations. And a parallel that's occurring to me is, at the moment, the discourse about COVID-19, and a discourse whereby we are at war with this virus, etc. And at least on our side, we've been really cautioning against using the word war for such, for a pandemic. Why? Because you also have unrest linked to the pandemic and so on and so forth. And so all of a sudden, if that violence and the response to that violence, or unrest and the violent response to that unrest, is conceived as armed conflict, and then, for instance, you might have military also intervening who might be less trained in law enforcement, etc., you run a risk of all of a sudden, switching into an IHL paradigm, which would be very, very dangerous. This is not to contradict what Patricia and Monica have said, because I, of course, completely agree with this concept of peace having to be a wholeful peace, and a peace that includes everyone and includes justice and human rights. But still, as lawyers, to be careful about not expanding too much the concept of armed conflict.
Thank you, Cordula. I think, Patty, did you want to jump in there, or was I mistaken? No? Okay. I think the point that you raise, Cordula, is really important. It's not that I think for many of us working, as feminists with international law, there's been this real anxiety, concern about the use of language in response to COVID-19. And, colleagues have continued to raise this, and we have, we actually do ourselves fall into the trap of fighting this disease and that is so dangerous to take that step forward. So it is about taking particular care over our own language, but then challenging state language that turns what is a public health situation into a militarized concept that enables them to utilize powers beyond. And I think this has happened in the anti-racist process that we've seen too. Monica, I think you want to jump in here.
Yes, just briefly. I think you are very right. Is that right? Can you hear me? I think it's very important to actually use terms correctly, that point that you just made, Luis, is crucial. Be quite rigorous about that. So conflict is not the same as armed conflict. So that is the key distinction there. So when we are talking about the sphere of international humanitarian law, we are talking about armed conflict. And then the beyond that we have been identifying, or at least I try to show the areas that are right now creating more dispute resolution, let's say, in my own practice, and that are quite violent sometimes. They are not armed conflicts. They are conflicts. Thank you.
Thank you, Monica. We've had quite a number of questions that have come in during the discussion. So I just want to highlight three. I'm not going to direct it to any one of you, but if you'd like to pick up on or comment on or respond to any of these. One is from Agnes, who has said, how is taking into account the feminist point of view in international organizations, such as, for example, the ICC, the International Criminal Court? Is it something that's well received? Is there any resistance among the staff and the judges? Before I look to turn to the next question, the one thing that we discovered on a personal level is when we spoke to those working in the institutions of the international organizations and raised this idea of seeing their work through a feminist peace prism, and even just peace, it came as a bit of a revelation to some of them, saying, oh, we've never really thought about that. You know, our work is in human rights, we've never really considered peace. This might be a different way of engaging with the very fabric of the law and law and policy. And so I hope that we have, through this project, you know, prompted people to rethink how they approach the law. But maybe, you know, some of our other panelists have spoken to those within the ICC. Patty, perhaps you have, but also you as part of, you know, that institution, you know, has thinking about feminist peace perspective, does that, to what extent is that well received? Would it be well received within an institution like the ICC? Etienne, Diamond has also asked another question. Thank you all for fascinating and insightful contributions, requests, questions, specifically Cordula. I'd be grateful if you could elaborate more on your point about the connection between the increasingly urbanized and protracted nature of armed conflict and its effects on women and girls in particular. And then from Susan, the international says sexual violence is a crime against humanity and a war crime. But if your country's domestic law doesn't define this in this way, how can women who face these offences in times of conflict get justice? How is, you know, how are they supposed to be able to resort to their own institutions? And what happens when there's a denial from the government? And I think this is perhaps really pertinent to the work that you're doing, Monica, but also to Mo, because I think these are realities that continually confront you as practitioners too. Are there any further examples? Would you like to elaborate on any of these? So given some of those questions, any of my panelists, I think, Monica, you really want to come back in here, or did I misread you? Monica, you're muted. Monica?
Sorry, yes, I was reading the questions. Yes, I can jump in with the question by Susan. Is that think address? Yes, to me. On sexual violence, well, I think quite important here will be a distinction between those countries that are monists and those countries that are not like that. Say, like England needs to have legislation in order to incorporate treaties. So a way to start would depend on what specific jurisdiction you are looking at. If it is a monist jurisdiction, then it is possible. It is possible to invoke standards that the state in question may have already upheld, for example, by the ratification of relevant treaties, and that to use that in courts in a manner that judges understand the obligations of the states, and particularly of the specific acts that these authorities may be taking place or may or need to take. So that is creating that kind of jurisprudence, clarifies the law and clarifies the ambit of the action that the state actors generally have to take. And I believe that that is quite crucial. If it is a state that is not a monist state, basically it requires enabling legislation, then lobbying for that type of legislation is important, to have that in place, you know, to have, not to have treaties that are unincorporated and therefore that cannot be invoked in courts when, for example, counsel brings a case, because that person is going to be left without justice. And I think that will be a move forward. That doesn't mean that we will achieve that immediately. It's process, because you not only have the need of the substantive law, but also the understanding of how procedurally that should be implemented. For example, in the United Kingdom, there has been a lot of discussion as to, although we have law, to what extent rape has not really been successful when it comes to prosecutions because of procedural issues, not because of absence of law. So I leave you with that, with those comments concerning that question.
Sorry, I think we lost Mo, and I I also lost myself in that. Thank you so much, Monica, for that intervention. Cortulo, did you want to jump in here? Because I was going to bring in Mo, but I think maybe her panel system went out then. Cortulo.
Yes, thanks. It's about the urbanized and protracted nature of conflict. So, I mean, my first example just maybe would be an example from the Second World War in Germany. You know, the women who reconstructed the cities when they were lying in rubble, they were actually called Trümmerfrauen, so the rubble women. And they were the ones who reconstructed the cities, because the men were not necessarily either back from the front or were missing or had died. But perhaps the more evident answer would be that there is indication now that as wars get more urbanized, the proportion of civilians that are affected by war is higher. And that, of course, means women and children will be also more affected, because they are the majority within the population of civilians. And I think then it's a question of really breaking down the consequences. And I think of looking more and trying to get more evidence about what the consequences of these specific contemporary conflicts can be on women. So, for instance, we know that urbanized conflicts lead to displacement. So who are the displaced in those conflicts, aggregated by gender, by age, etc. The crowdedness of urbanized spaces as well. So the place is crowded. It means that when infrastructure breaks down, there is a higher risk of spreading disease, for instance. Now, how does this play out between men, women, girls and boys? Often the women or girls and boys will be affected more, either for reasons that they are already weakened because of lack of nutrition, etc., but also perhaps lesser access to healthcare in such situations. So again, breaking it down. Similarly, for the protractedness of conflict, I think we know more and more that the protractedness of conflict leads to breakdowns in infrastructure, but also in societal structures and coping mechanisms. And that leads us back to this tying the public and the private together, because that then leads to societies which might be more fragmented, more violent as well. So more violence will also lead to more domestic violence for women, for children. So again, I think it's about these effects that are compounded. But I think in the protractedness of conflict, there is something very interesting to look at the how the public violence then pervades the private sphere. I'll leave it at that. There would be many more sort of examples to give, but my point is perhaps also to say that we need to look at those characteristics of these conflicts that we have today and that are to come, and look at how these characteristics will play out differently for men, women, girls.
Thank you, Cortula. We have actually quite a few questions coming in. I want to take the next two together, really, because they deal with the matter theory. The first one is from Vivian, and she asks this: how can we reconcile the legal and conceptual understanding of peace versus conflict that on the one hand ensures clarity for application of the relevant legal regimes, and on the other hand move away from the binary notions towards a feminist perspective? And this is, if any of you can answer this, perhaps you'll resolve all the issues that we faced over the last 2 years. but then to also take another question that has been raised by Zaina Elad, and she says this: can feminist legal theory help with creating new spaces to address cases of non-armed conflicts and protracted refugee status? I really wanted to bring in Mo here, but I think we really have lost her. These cases are more often than not norm and not the exception, and this is the very point, given the realities of displacement and conflict in parts of Central America, for example, in the Middle East, East Africa, etc. So I don't know whether any of you want to pick up on either of those, you know, this difficulty that we as feminist sort of scholars, we academics face with, you know, sort of the disconnect again, for want of a better term, between theory and practice, between, you know, sort of working with the law and then seeing the inadequacies of the law. You know, it's really difficult. Would any of you, Monica, would you like to come in here? Or Patty, sorry. Monica, and then I'll bring in Patty.
So Patty can go.
Let me just jump in quickly, and I think that to acknowledge it, I think the question really hits the heart of the issue, this conceptualization and at the same time the practice, and that we're very much in one sense stuck on trying to come up with a definition of what is peace, or let's use some of the language, UN language, peaceful existence. What is peaceful existence when we keep running into, well, let's distinguishing it from militarized existence or militarized practice. So that our very positing of the question and linking it militarization stops us from really getting to a definition. So I think that we have to acknowledge that. But on the other hand, I think that we have to completely see different legal processes that we're involved in, whether it's human rights litigation or international criminal litigation, to say that its object was never to necessarily declare innocence or guilt, and therefore that means we have peace. And so we shouldn't give the burden on that procedure for something it was not constructed to do. It was almost per se to look at the violation, to look at the prohibition, to look at what was illegal and how that was what destroys peaceful existence, even if we haven't understood what is a gendered peace or a feminist peace. And I do want to bring in one other issue, and I think that it's very important that we don't keep relying on peace as something that can only come from the resolution between two states, or the resolution between a state and, as Monica says, someone in armed conflict. We have to look at really what has already been brought up, that peace sometimes comes from the bottom. The Mothers of Plaza de Mayo, peace came up from the bottom. Peace comes up when it identifies what is unpeaceful in our communities by female activists, by feminist theory understanding that, and by questions of racial injustice. I would certainly say that migrants who are living in refugee camps during prolonged periods of times, persons who are enslaved, persons who are slave traded, might not be in a situation of armed conflict and might not even be in a situation of conflict as perceived by the states and their society. But they certainly are not in a situation that I would call a peaceful situation or peaceful existence.
Yeah.
Monica.
So those are wonderful remarks by Patricia. I want to pay my homage to her in this forum, because Patricia has been such a inspiration. I mean, her work has been pioneering and has personally inspired me to do good litigation, and I think that we shouldn't forget that we are learning from each other, and that there is you know, new lawyers and new generation to come to build from what it has been done. So a couple of things what she mentioned relevant to the questions that were made. Number one, the distinction between theory and what is happening in practice, and are they divorced? Look, when you actually come from the perspective of the one that is suffering the impact of whatever, you know, conflict is there, is the one that wants remedies. And to me, what matters is it doesn't matter whether you call it, you go in one way or another. It's the getaway can be. There can be many possibilities. So many jurisdictional tribunals, you can find jurisdiction in many ways. What matters in my experience is that once you are in that tribunal, that the law should be stayed as it is. But it is not so, for example, I gave you an example of bringing a case that essentially was a case where there had been an armed conflict, but bringing that via the gate of a human rights court that had at that point, jurisdiction to actually look into what had happened. And I think I got that result thanks to being able to, number one, distinguish that jurisdictional gate from getting there, understanding what treaty they are applying, and then how do you contextualize that treaty, and how the Vienna Convention on the Law of the Treaties can bring, you know, general international law to properly understand the obligations of the state. So from the perspective of the litigator, I say that as a litigator, you have to have clear the law and all these fine distinctions that Cordula, for example, has made, you know, understanding properly the regime of a IHL if you're going to use it. But at the same time, being creative as to forums that you possibly could use. For example, the South Sudan case. I mean, I advised on a case being brought before the CEDAW committee, which had the jurisdiction to be able to look into that. So I think that that can be very creative. Don't get stuck on you know, just the conceptualization of things. Law is always a living thing, and you understand better when it's in motion. And when it comes to courts, I think you actually see how all of that comes together. But I do think that it's very important that more cases are brought, because the law needs to be tested, and the law needs to come to a point where you state it in a clear manner so that it goes back to the practice and states cannot say that they are unaware, that they don't understand, because it's been clarified. And finally, I think that what Patty has just said about peace coming from the bottom, I think is also crucial. I mean, let's not forget of the power that every single individual may have in making a mark, in leaving a mark in the law, like the women's that we have discussed. On displacement. Displacement may be seen from different angles. It could well be seen as a fundamentally human rights issue when it comes as an ongoing, you see. And I think that there may be many possibilities to resort, depending on the state in question, depending on the victims in question, to be able to find a remedy. Now, issues of displacement are going to come not only as a result of having to leave because of armed conflict, but also nowadays, even because of climate change. And some of those issues are already coming up before courts, and we'll see more of that possibly in the future. Thanks.
Thank you, Monica, for those really wise interventions. Oh, yes, Cordula?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, it's really just to subscribe to everything that Monica said, and perhaps really emphasize this thing about the law is also what we make of it and how we use it. And perhaps to give a bit of more of an upbeat vision of that, you know, because to my mind, it is true that, you know, the law is a construct which derives from power, of course, and the powerful are not necessarily always those that people like Monica represent. But while it's not perfect, you know, human rights law, humanitarian law, refugee law are still protective bodies of law. And I would say that with all the developments also we have both in treaty as well as in case law, they, you know, they provide 80% of what is needed, to just give a, you know, bit of a figure. So they're not perfect, but they've made huge advances. It also ties in perhaps to what Patricia said a few minutes back, when she said, you know, we're not anymore in the 70s and 80s. This is not the time anymore, for instance, where you could say, well, human rights law doesn't deal with rape anymore, for instance, right? So, I mean, these are very strong and powerful bodies of law. To my mind, perhaps the weakest link in those is the part of international humanitarian law that deals with the conduct of hostilities. So the principles of distinction, proportionality, and precaution, because they are meant to find a balance between military necessity and humanity, but they are so vague that the most powerful players that use and interpret them, so the states and non-state armed groups and their armed forces, tend to interpret them perhaps more in favor of military necessity than we as humanitarians would sometimes prefer. But if we, and to take this old word, if we, you know, if we deconstruct also the existing rules, I think we have to then always think about how do we reconstruct or how do we construct something better. And it seems to me that today, so as we're speaking now, this would be highly ambitious, if not impossible. And at least I think, and I think many people think, that if we were to build a framework of international law and these protective bodies like the 1949 Geneva Conventions, the 1979 CEDAW Convention, we are unlikely to get what we got then, particularly when you look at the backlash against women's rights today. So I think perhaps, and that's perhaps, again, I want to emphasize or tie into what Patricia says, that the most promising way to this question about how do we reconcile the legal and conceptual understanding and of conflict versus peace, and on the one hand ensure clarity of application, and on the other hand move away from binary ways of seeing it that don't really protect people in the way that we want, lies in the way of how we interpret the rules in today's conflict and how we fight for good and protective interpretation of those rules. So we need, again, we need a strong evidence base and good arguments to talk about and to show that we need these protective interpretations. So good evidence about how the interpretation and application of those rules will play out for men, women, boys and girls. And we also need to look always about who is the interpreter of the rule? What is their interest? Which position of power are they in? Has the perspective of women, but also the objective to empower women, not just their perspective, but the objective to empower women, been taken into account in this interpretation?
Thank you, Cordula, for that intervention. You basically said everything I wanted to say, but far more eloquently, as usual. Before I thank my panelists and bring this to a close, I just wanted to highlight a couple of other items, other events that are coming up over the next couple of weeks, but especially over the next week. This week we're going to be posting some more contributions by performers who we've invited to perform with music, etc., and to think about their and to use the same prism that we're engaging in as lawyers, this idea of feminist peace. And we have some wonderful performances coming up, so please keep your eye on our website, which, as I said, where we'll be posting some of these videos, and also we'll be advertising through social media. Next panel discussion is going to be on Thursday 17th, which is hosted by the LSE Library and co-hosted by the Centre. This event we are going to be discussing, can we archive memories, Greenham Commons Women's Peace Camp and beyond. Then on the 21st of September, we will be involved in, and Oxfam will be hosting, but we are also involved in another panel discussion, Transforming Power to Put Women at the Heart of Peace Building. And then finally, the one that I want to draw your attention to is Wednesday the 23rd. This is one that we are hosting, Strategies and Practices for Gender Just Peace Building. So I would like now to turn to back to my panelists to thank you all for having spent your time, shared your insights, shared your ideas around feminist vision for peace. I personally have learned so much from you, benefited from this session. So thank you all very much indeed.